So, last week, I started on dealing with this film that's out there, Darkest Hour, which I'm told there's a British radio program that's already had me on the first interview on this, and they've got more following up because this film is set to win all the Academy Award, Oscars, Best Film, Best Actor, all the rest of it. So they're absolutely convinced of it. And, of course, it's just set. It's not about which is the best film or best actors. Are they giving the message that Hollywood wants you to get? Because what is the Academy Awards? Academy Awards is a group of mutual back-slapping, back-scratching. I give you a gold statue this year, you give me a gold statue next year. It's just a marketing scam for people in the trade because it means absolutely nothing. The Hollywood filmmakers are telling you what films they think you should go and watch. It's to draw attention to films that you wouldn't bother to watch otherwise. And so it's just a marketing ploy. Just like these best-selling books. The best-selling books is a complete and total and utter scam. And you can tell it immediately because they never have the Bible at the top of the best-selling books. So when I've asked them, whoever's been doing the best-selling books, and said, how did you determine this? Because I noticed it doesn't have the Bible or James Dobson or James Kennedy or so many, you know, authors who sell millions of copies, and the Bible tens of millions, actually in the hundreds of millions, and you're trying to tell me that this book or another is... They said, no, well, we don't have the Bible. And no, we don't have Christian books. And, well, you should say that. You know, the best-selling pagan books or something. How do you determine this? Because sometimes there's even secular books that did better than their bestsellers. No, they tell from 10 selected exclusive bookshops around South Africa. So it doesn't matter what's sold at Lux Verbi, Kumbook, Script Union, or anything like this, or independent bookshop. It's just, and in America, it's even less. And it's a couple of New York and Los Angeles bookshops. And who cares about what people are buying in Dallas or Des Moines? It's all about the in places and, you know, what Los Angeles and what New York thinks. In South Africa, it'll be what exclusive books in Cavendish Square and the one up in Sandton says, you know, and that's what they say is the best-selling books. But even then, they've excluded anything Christian or Bible. Same with Academy Awards. Don't think Warham or Courageous or Fireproof is going to win, or The Case for Christ. That's not even going to be considered, because it doesn't matter how good the film is. It's the message. And if the message isn't endorsing secular humanism, they won't promote it. The sin most condemned in the Bible is idolatry. And Winston Churchill is an idol. Winston Churchill is to South Africa, is to Britain, and much of the English-speaking world, what Mandela is to South Africa, what Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. is to America, what Lenin was to the Soviet Union, and what Mao was to Red China. An idol, complete idol. So last week, went through evaluating the film. And we stopped right here on surprising success of Churchill's oratory. So part two. People involved in public speaking noted that Churchill addressed not the real people with their skepticism and their materialism, but he addressed an heroic people of his own imagination, the living embodiment of great historic tradition. Churchill drew on the broad sweep of English history, recalling the battles of Agincourt, when archers defeated the French cavalry, at the Battle of Trafalgar, Lord Nelson's most famous victory, which actually meant little or nothing to most of his listeners. In fact, most of his listeners were not well enough educated to have even known about these things anyway. Yet he succeeded in invoking a pride and imperial glory and national destiny that for most British people had died long before, if it had ever existed at all. Yet Churchill's speeches worked. Despite their archaic language and the occasional colloquialism amidst high-flowing phrases and flashes of cheeky humor, delivered with a strangely compelling voice. Churchill's speeches were resonant with high emotion, which is quite unusual for the British people at that time. You weren't meant to be getting that emotional in public. Churchill demonstrated an effective dramatic simplicity in his brilliant speeches, such as after the desperate evacuation of the British Expeditionary Force, virtually the entire army, from the beaches of Dunkirk. "We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." Now, you might not be aware, but that's actually a speech he borrowed from an Irish Republican Army person who'd given that very same speech not that long before. So this is actually an IRA speech, but nevertheless, with the exception of France. But everything else was his. He had basically adapted. This is great. I mean, this is really powerful rhetoric. And Churchill's impressive speech-making abilities may have clouded a more pertinent question. Was it even necessary to fight this war? Germany had never declared war on Britain. Never, ever. Germany had always been Britain's ally. Germany never wanted to fight Britain. Germany was offering the most generous peace terms imaginable for a victorious army. Why could Britain not just go away and end the naval blockade and aerial bombardment of Germany? What could they lose? What was to be gained? Indeed, what was gained from British perspective by the war? Germany was doing well. Germany did not want war with Britain. They'd done well in the Olympics. After the dramatic and complete military defeat of France, which was the military superpower of the world at that time, just what everyone in 1939 would have said, the French army is the greatest army in the world, or at least they thought so. Within a mere 6 weeks, wham, knocked out. I mean, what hadn't been done in 4 years in the First World War was done in 6 weeks in the Second. And Churchill demonstrated again his inspired journalist knack of coining an unforgettable phrase, the Battle of France is over. I expect that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. In fact, one of the most brilliant propaganda films ever made, the Battle of Britain, begins with this very speech, which is very resonant. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say this was their finest hour. I mean, this is great speech making, brilliant rhetoric, great words, inspiring, but was it even true? In what way can we claim that our own times are the finest hour for an empire that has already, up till then, had survived for several centuries? Many historians would say that Britain's 19th century naval campaign against the slave trade, clearing the oceans of slave ships, setting countless captives free, that was the finest hour. And this book is one book I'm very glad that we had a hand in helping to produce, the Royal Navy versus the slave trades, 19th century Royal Navy. I think that might have been Britain's finest hour, personally. I think that was far more noble achievement. The greatest century of missions, I think, was an even better finest hour for Britain. Indeed, there are many worthy contenders for the title, their finest hour. After the Battle of Britain, there was the famous tribute to the gallant pilots of Fighter Command. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. Memorable, inspiring, unforgettable. However, once again, surely gross presumption and exaggeration. Would not those words have been more appropriately attributed to King Leonidas and his 300 Spartans? The Battle of Thermopylae, 480 BC, when an initial Greek fighting force of 7,000 blocked the path of the Persian army, claimed to number over 1 million for 7 days. And when their position was outflanked, King Leonidas dismissed the bulk of the Greek army and remained to safeguard their retreat with 300 Spartans, 700 Thespians, and 400 Thebans, who all fought to the last man. That bold, sacrificial, delaying action enabled the Greek navy to withdraw to Salamis, where they later won a great victory against the Persian navy and effectively saved Europe from Asiatic control. Surely they could say, never before in a field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few. I would think King Leonidas and his 300 Spartans earned that title far more nobly. Similarly, you could recount the courageous siege of Malta, where a few hundred knights of St. John held out against a vast Turkish army of over 40,000 initially, later reinforced, in a siege of almost 4 months, helping to save Western Europe from invasion. The decisive Battle of Lepanto in 1571 and the successful raising of the siege of Vienna in 1683 are surely far more worthy recipients of such an accolade. Never before in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. But you see, in those cases, it was Christianity against Islam. It was Christianity against paganism. It was Europe against Asia. And that's not the kind of way that the multicultural New World Order wants to think today. But Winston Churchill achieved something far more important than saving Western Christian civilization. He helped save the Soviet Union. And for that, he gets the undying loyalty and appreciation of Hollywood and the Academy Awards. Churchill's speeches, however, were backed up with impressive photo ops, press, rousing newsreels, strategic personal appearances, all designed to promote war propaganda and further mobilize the nation and the empire in a war at all costs to the very end. And you'll have to look very, very, very carefully to see the South African flag here. In fact, I can't see it. But you'll notice the Soviet flag is right behind the Union Jack and the US flag. And I mean, really, honestly and truly, allied with the Soviet Union. You can see some very interesting propaganda posters. Let us go forward together. You know, that is about as mindless and meaningless as the kind of propaganda you get today. Go forward where? You know, who's us, by the way? Don't see you going in the front. Women of Britain, come into the factories. Yay. So much more meaningful to produce bombs to tear other people's father's part than to be at home raising your own children, isn't it? Help Britain finish a job. What job? This man is your friend. Russian. Notice the ham and sickle, red star. Yep. He fights for freedom. You have got to be kidding. This is produced by Churchill's propaganda department. And then they make it look really, yay, wonderful about 1,000 bomber raids. What is actually wonderful about the 1,000 bomber raids bombing places like Cologne and Bremen? It's extraordinary that Winston Churchill came to be so popular with the common people, as he was probably the most ostentatiously self-indulgent leader who's ever been appointed to 10 Downing Street. He woke up at about 8 a.m. to be served a copious breakfast of multiple courses, dispatch box of telegrams and memorandums. He stayed in bed for most of the morning, dictating to his secretaries, who had to be in his bedroom to take his dictation while he's in bed having his breakfast, and smoking his cigars. His first bath the day followed. He generally had two baths each day. He changed his shirt 3 times a day. Each of his 3 meals a day were massive and included brandy and cigars. My rule of life prescribed as an absolutely sacred rite smoking cigars and also drinking alcohol before, after, and if be need be, during all meals and in the intervals between them. So that's a sacred rite. Churchill frequently embarrassed officials by appearing like a Roman emperor in his bath towel, dripping in the bathroom at all hours a day. Daily, his secretaries had to take dictation from him while he luxuriated in the bath. They would have to sit and take dictation while he's bathing, with cigar and brandy in hand, of course. He was described by those who worked for him as rude, overbearing, loquacious, moody, insulting, and arbitrary. His long-suffering wife, Clementine, warned him, "There is a danger of you being generally disliked by your colleagues and subordinates because of your rough, sarcastic, and overbearing manner." And in fact, some of the things that she said are really quite incredible. Desmond Morton, his long-trusted advisor, expressed horror at the depth of selfish brutality revealed in Churchill's sudden rages against those who crossed him. His egotism and irascible temper were legendary and was mentioned in the diaries of many generals, like General George Patton, who was horrified to see his behavior at the Casablanca Conference in Morocco, where in a Muslim country he was demanding alcohol to be served, which was against their rules. Churchill's intake of alcohol was continuous throughout the day. His comment, "I've taken more out of alcohol than alcohol has taken out of me." Churchill harried his subordinates with a never-ending stream of queries and instructions which could seriously disrupt the vital work of whole ministries by sudden, importunate demands for information and action. Some officials later recorded they felt they were fighting a war more against Churchill than Hitler. The Navy in particular was continuously trying to prevent Churchill's dream of a successful rerun of his most disastrous Gallipoli campaign of 1915, when the British lost massive amounts of battleships, cruisers, destroyers. It was just ridiculous. "Ships don't fight forts," said Lord Nelson, but Churchill thought otherwise, and he sent in his battleships to take one of the most well-defended straits in the world. At the mouth of the Dardanelles, Gallipoli, they call it, the pathway is 3 miles wide. And then it broadens out in the middle, and then it narrows to 2 miles at Constantinople. And he wanted battleships to sail between the pillboxes and entrenched artillery pieces there and try and take Constantinople from the sea, which, of course, is impossible. And when that failed, he sent in the Anzacs, the Australians and the New Zealanders, and they lost 250,000 men dead in this campaign, and they achieved nothing. And they lost more capital ships there in that action than even lost at the Battle of Jutland, which was one of the most serious naval battles in history. As Minister of Defence, Churchill summed up his method in one witty phrase: "All I want is compliance with my wishes." Churchill could simultaneously direct grand international political and military strategy and intervene to determine the size of jam rations or demand an increase in the output of playing cards for gambling. I mean, this man was the master of micromanagement. Churchill insisted on being given a delivery, a selection of ultra-secret decrypts every day. These were often delivered by the head of MI6, Sir Stuart Menzies, in person. Menzies tried to make sure that there was at least one juicy, scandalous item a day to suit the Prime Minister's palate. Churchill loved to spring secret information on the uninitiated to clinch an argument, thus triumphing in a debate from an unassailable position of strength, because it's a breach of national security to query the source of his intelligence. It was so ultra-secret, you couldn't even mention ultra. Couldn't even mention GC and CS, the General Code and Cipher School. Couldn't even mention the initials. And it was so secret, it was completely wrapped up for 60 years after the war. You weren't allowed to even bring this out about how they won the war, because it was considered a breach of national security, even when the technology was way past. And the only conclusion people could come up with is that they didn't want people to know that they actually knew everything about the enemy's disposition ahead of time through the ultra secret, through the code breaking. Churchill's military strategy was summed up in two words: blockade and bombard. Naval blockade and aerial bombardment. And here you can see the beginning of the aerial bombardments and the targets in Germany already starting in 1939. Already from the 7th of September, Britain was bombing targets in Germany, mostly naval bases at first. And you can see all these blue dots are British targets where the British are bombing. The poor French lost more people to Allied bombardment from their liberators, allies, than they lost in the war with Germany. So the ridiculous thing is that the Allies killed more French than the enemy did, theoretically. And now the red dots are where the American Air Force are bombing, and the blue are where the British Air Force is bombing. And you can just see the devastation caused as they go all the way through, flattening whole cities. To which he later added sabotage. SOE, we looked at this in the history of terrorism last year. So this was rearranged into the three S's: strategic bombing, which means bombing of cities, saturation bombing, sabotage, and subversion, meaning starting what we would call today terrorist groups, but they called them partisans, resistance, but they were bombing and assassinating, poisoning and so on. Within just 5 days of becoming Prime Minister, he had already ordered Bomber Command to raid the industrial areas of the Ruhr in Germany, bombing urban centres. He diverted a high proportion of Britain's limited resources to the strategic bombing of Germany, with some of the biggest bombs you can imagine. I mean, that's a 10,000 kilometre or 22,000 pound bomb. Unbelievable. One of those, by the way, destroyed the Dom, the main cathedral in Berlin. It dropped a 10,000 kilogram bomb right through the main dome of the cathedral. He diverted a high proportion to this. He was not at all put off by the fact that the bombing offensives of 1940 and 1941 were actually a series of fiascos. The night attacks were costly and inaccurate and had no effect on German war production, and they killed more British flies than even German civilians died in these bombings for 2 years. And when the French government surrendered, Churchill showed his ruthlessness by ordering the sinking of the French fleet at Oran and seizing all of the French ships in British waters violently. And the fact that the Royal Navy could go from being your friend and ally to sinking them within literally days still stuns the French. Churchill continually sought to convince himself and those around him of the success of his strategies and of the truth of his own speeches. However, the generals and admirals around him were well aware that, contrary to his broadcasts and speeches, Britain was not winning the war. The German people were not demoralized, nor was the German economy anywhere near a breaking point. It wasn't even on a full war footing yet. And Churchill continued to speak about how the people are about to break and morale in Germany is terrible and how the occupied countries hated them, and yet that's not the way it looked like on the ground to the Wehrmacht, who were welcomed like they were liberators in Ukraine, for example. Darkest Hour, the film, showcases some of the great speeches of Winston Churchill, including, "Without victory, there can be no survival." That makes rousing patriotic speech, but is it true? There are many countries that have experienced defeat in war that have survived and even thrived. As Reverend Bill Bathman pointed out in his book Going Through, when he first arrived as a missionary in Europe in 1951, Britain was economically depressed and looked like they had lost the war. There was still rubble in the streets. There was still rationing in Britain, but not in Germany in 1951. He said Germany, which had been savagely bombed by almost non-stop 1,000 bomber raids day and night, which turned the cities into literally rubble, Germany in the 1950s looked like they had won the Second World War. And the phenomenal work ethic of the Germans rebuilt the country faster and better than Britain had. Britain didn't have that much damage to repair anyway. And literally out of the rubble, cities were rebuilt, normally by the women, because the men were either killed or in concentration camps in Soviet Union, work as slaves for the French and all the rest. And nowhere more impressively than in Dresden. We could see the first thing they did was restore the statue of Martin Luther, and in time, the church, the city, and symbolic of the reconstruction of a city that had been turned to absolute rubble in the incineration of the firebombing. France was defeated by Germany in 1871 and in 1940, and France survived much better than it did with the apparent victory in the First World War. Theoretically, the French ended on the victor side in the First World War, and in the First World War, the French lost 1.3 million men killed. In the Second World War, which they lost, you can see the French lost far more men than the British Empire or the United States. When it comes to the Second World War, the French deaths are almost insignificant by war stage. You can see the French, where they're, that's the French deaths versus the other parts. And quite plainly, in the Second World War, they lost under 100,000. So that's where they lost. So where they won, they had 13 times more deaths for their victory than they had for their defeat. At least from the German army. More French people were killed by Allied bombardments in the liberation than died in the war before it. Even Poland, which suffered more than most countries in the Second World War and was decisively defeated by both the Germans on the west and the Russians in the east, Poland survives and in fact thrives and one of the freest nations in Europe today, despite having suffered one of the most catastrophic atrocities in the extermination of the entire leadership element in the Katyn Forest Massacre. My own father, who fought all 6 years of the Second World War in the Royal Artillery, most of it in North Africa and Egypt, and fighting against the Africa Corps, who he greatly respected, my father observed, "If we could have seen what would happen to Britain after the war, we would not have fought against one another, we would have fought together against a real enemy," which actually he saw as France. As the darkest hour so dramatically demonstrates, Winston Churchill used rhetoric to harden public opinion against a peaceful resolution. He really did marshal the English language and send it off to war. But was it worth it? Was it necessary? What did it achieve? One of the most intense scenes in Darkest Hour is where Winston Churchill bellows at his war cabinet, "You cannot reason with a tiger while your head is in its mouth." Again, great turn of phrase. But in what sense is this true? the vast British Empire was by no means in any tiger's mouth. I mean, Germany's there. There's Britain. Here's the British Empire. How is your head in the tiger's mouth? You've got this phenomenal empire, this colossal navy, and the British Empire was not in any tiger's mouth. Nonsense. As the English Channel had stopped Napoleon forces 150 years before, so it would prove an insurmountable obstacle to Hitler's panzers. As Patrick Buchanan points out in his Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War book, Germany never had an aircraft carrier, never produced a landing craft or four-engine bomber. Evidently, Germany didn't even intend to cross the Channel. It was evident by the very weapons of the Wehrmacht, the Kriegsmarine, and the Luftwaffe that world domination was never the aim, only domination on the European continent. World domination is what Britain, France, United States, and Japan had with their massive empires. I mean, just notice, you've got to really concentrate, see how big Germany was then. And then you see the French Empire, see all the purple sections here. French Empire's huge, huge. The Japan Empire, massive area that they controlled. As for the Americans, as for the British Empire, all the red sections, they were the world dominating powers. What's this business that Germany was seeking world domination? The British and French already had it. And especially with their predominance of aircraft carriers and huge naval fleets. Now, the British had 13 aircraft carriers in the Second World War. Japan had 11. I think America had 12. Germany had none. France had 3. I mean, how can you build domination without an aircraft carrier? These are just some. These are 3 British aircraft carriers in a row working together. These are American aircraft carriers and destroyers. I mean, wow. How are you going to have world domination without aircraft carriers? Here's some of the American aircraft carriers. If Germany wanted world domination, it would have helped them to demand the surrender of France's naval fleet, because the French naval fleet was 40% the size of the British, which made it 4 times the size of the German Kriegsmarine. So the German Kriegsmarine was barely 10% the size of the Royal Navy. How are you going to have world domination when your navy cannot even come up to not even 20% off the Royal Navy's strength? And the Royal Navy is not on its own. It's allied with how many others? France's navy was 4 times the size of Germany's Kriegsmarine. However, despite the Allies having demanded the German high seas fleet and the merchant marine at the end of the First World War, Germany never attempted to demand France's fleet, even after their decisive 6-week blitzkrieg victory over France. Now, Winston Churchill famously declared time and again, it's impossible to compromise with dictators. Fine sentiment, except that he had once been a great admirer of El Duce, Mussolini, the dictator of Italy. Churchill praised Mussolini in these words, "I could not help being charmed by Signor Mussolini's gentle and simple bearing and by his calm, detached poise in spite of so many burdens and dangers. If I were Italian, I am sure I would have been with you entirely from the beginning. What a man. I've lost my heart. Fascism has rendered a service to the entire world." That is a quote from Winston Churchill, referring to El Duce Mussolini. And Mussolini, to be fair, had achieved a tremendous amount in reorganizing, disciplining, bringing up Italy, making their once worthless lira a solid currency. In fact, Mussolini had done a lot of good for Italy. And yet later on, he spoke about him like he was one of the most evil people on the planet. This is Winston Churchill being inconsistent. As late as November the 7th, 1938, when he was already the most open critic of Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill was quoted in London Times saying about Adolf Hitler, "I have always said that if Great Britain were defeated in war, I hope we should find a Hitler to lead us back to our rightful position among the nations. Those who have met Herr Hitler have found a highly competent, cool, well-informed functionary with an agreeable manner, a disarming smile, and few have been unaffected by subtle personal magnetism." Now, it's not the most warm praise Adolf Hitler received, but this is from his main enemy, his primary number one nemesis, the one who was the most vocal in his rhetoric against Adolf Hitler, and yet he could admit to a whole lot of positives. But he says you can't compromise with dictators. Now, interesting as those quotes about Mussolini and Adolf Hitler are, the mass effect of Hitler is Winston Churchill compromised with the most bloodthirsty dictator in the history of mankind, Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union, the man who gets the Guinness Book of Records for being the most bloodthirsty mass murderer. As Pat Buchanan observed, Churchill knew of the mass murders on Lenin's orders, the massacres of the Tsar's family, Stalin's slave labor camps, the forced starvation in the Ukraine, the Holodomor, the great purge of the old comrades and the Russian officer corps, the show trials, which had about 650,000 people executed, the rape of Finland and the Baltic republics, and Catan, meaning the murder of the Polish officer corps. As historian John Lewis Gaddis writes, the number of deaths resulting from Stalin's policies before the Second World War was between 17 and 22 million. These days, actually, we know it was in excess of 36 million. 1,000 times the number of deaths attributed to Hitler as of 1939. The heaviest number that anyone could say that before the start of the invasion of Poland on the 1st of September 1939, the number of people that could have been killed by Adolf Hitler or any members of the Nazi party, any of the German army, the whole lot combined, would have been somewhere close to 300. Most of which were the SA, the stormtroopers of Ernst Röhm, who was personally killed by Adolf Hitler. He was a socialist revolutionary who was working for a second revolution, and Adolf Hitler personally shot him in his bed with his homosexual lover, with his Luger, and something which shocked even Mussolini. Couldn't believe the utter ruthlessness of Adolf Hitler to deal with someone who had been key in bringing him to power, but when it came to a matter of principle, he took him out personally. He didn't send someone else. He walked in himself and he shot Ernst Röhm, who was the leader of the 3 million strong stormtroopers, the SA, which was bigger than the German army, much bigger. And he took him on. And they killed a few hundred in the Night of the Long Knives, which was basically communists and socialists who were wanting a revolution within Germany. So as of September 1939, Adolf Hitler, by the greatest stretch of imagination, might have been responsible for up to 300 deaths total. That includes Kristallnacht, the whole lot, which he immediately, when he heard about it, ordered the police and army to stop these people burning synagogues and attacking when a German diplomat had been assassinated by a Jewish terrorist in Paris, and Kristallnacht erupted, and he was furious, and he and Hess did everything they could to stop this madness, as they called it. But even if you put that blame on them too, he had killed maximum 300, and Stalin had killed anything from 17 to 36 million, depending on whose stat you take it. And yet, Churchill was clamoring for war on Hitler and an alliance with Stalin. Does that make any sense? In 1919, Winston Churchill had no doubt that of all the tyrannies in history, the Bolshevik tyranny is the worst, the most destructive, the most degrading. The atrocities committed under Vladimir Lenin and Trotsky were incomparably more hideous on a larger scale and more numerous than any for which the Kaiser is responsible. And he had been the number one advocate to blame the Kaiser for everything in the First World War, which wasn't justified. But this is coming from Winston Churchill. He's saying the Bolshevik regime is the most terrible and the worst and the most destructive and the most degrading tyranny in history. Yet Churchill could condemn Neville Chamberlain for being naive about Hitler at Munich in 1938, and yet 25 years later, after Lenin's revolution and the Red Terror, he declared that the more he met Stalin, the more he grew to like that man, that truly great man, the father of a nation. And here he is presenting a crusader sword at Yalta to Stalin, a crusader sword worth a fortune. I mean, this is something that should be in a museum, and he gives it to a bloodthirsty Marxist Bolshevik Antichrist pagan Satanist, and he hands him a crusader sword like he's the defender of Christian civilization. Far from compromising or refusing to compromise with dictators, in order to placate Stalin, Churchill ordered the assassination of General Wroclaw Sikorski, Polish commander-in-chief and prime minister of the Polish government in exile, on the 4th of July 1943 in a highly suspicious so-called aircraft accident off Gibraltar. General Sikorski was demanding an international Red Cross investigation of the Catan Forest massacre. Churchill privately admitted he realized it was the Soviet Union who had massacred the entire Polish officer corps at Katyn. Even the British textbooks probably to this day say the Germans did it. That's what my school textbook said when I was studying. Germans did Katyn Forest Massacre. In fact, that's what they said at Nuremberg trial, and they hung a whole lot of people for the crime of it, even while a marshal of the Soviet Army, Red Army, was sitting on the judges panel who was personally involved in the Katyn Forest Massacre. And apparently every single person in the courtroom knew the Soviets were responsible as they solemnly passed judgment on Germans and ordered people executed for something that they knew they themselves had done. I had Polish people point this out to me. I mean, notice, that's Latvia, that's Lithuania, Germany's over here, Poland. There's Katyn, there's Smolensk. And when you look at this, you start to understand, okay, how could the Germans have done the Katyn Forest Massacre? This is so deep into Russia. And yet, that's why none of our history books ever gave us a map of where Katyn was. We just had to believe. The Germans killed the Polish officers at Katyn, but Sikorsky's demand for International Red Cross investigation placed a strain on the alliance between the United States and the United Kingdom and the Soviet Union. Look here again. The American, the British, there's the South African flag, and there's the Soviet flag. We're in alliance with this most brutal of dictatorships. Sikorsky had to go. And the fact that Stalin ordered a breaking off of diplomatic relations with the Polish government in exile over this request was as good as an admission of Soviet guilt. Like, for example, in Zimbabwe. The World Council Church, others like to say, oh, well, the murder of the missionaries, like at Elam Mission Massacre 1978 in Rhodesia, that must have been done by the Rhodesian Zulu scouts as a black op in order to put a bad impression on ZANU-PF of Robert Mugabe. But Robert Mugabe, when he became president, refused to allow a monument to be placed at Elam for the people who died, ordered the school's name to be changed. When I went there, it was called the Eagle School. It wasn't called Elam School anymore. There was no plaque. Nobody could remember the dates. You weren't allowed to have any memorial services. It was forbidden to mention it. It wasn't mentioned in the textbooks. It wasn't mentioned in the media. In fact, it was forbidden to mention it. Just like the Katyn Forest Massacre was completely censored in Poland by the Russians. So on the one hand, they want to blame the enemies, but on the other hand, they won't let you talk about it or observe it. Now, you can see this is plainly an admission of guilt when they broke off all diplomatic relations. Here is General Sikorsky. There is Stalin. There is Stalin, there is General Sikorsky. Here's General de Gaulle of France. He's meant to be the French government in exile. And Winston Churchill, of course, and there's General Sikorsky. Again, Sikorsky, Churchill, de Gaulle. There's Roosevelt, there's General Sikorsky of Poland. General de Gaulle, meant to be representing Free France, so-called, and Churchill. And here again, you've got de Gaulle, Churchill, Sikorsky. So, I mean, you can see that these are the allies. But at this point, from the expression on Churchill's face, and there's General Sikorsky, you can kind of see he's had enough of Sikorsky. And this is in 1943. This is June 1943. Sikorsky's insisting on full international investigation, the Katyn Forest Massacre, and Churchill then orders Sikorsky to go through to inspect the Polish soldiers in the 8th Army in North Africa, which required him to fly there. And so he had to fly by Gibraltar, which is the tip of Spain, and which was British controlled, still is. And General Sikorsky went through and made some speeches in North Africa, and Polish officers and others of the 8th Army, could have included my father, he was in the general area at the time. The official version states that General Sikorsky and his entire leadership staff, the whole leadership element of the Polish government exile, including his daughter, Sofia, perished when their RAF Liberator plane, that's an American-made four-engine plane, crashed into the sea only 16 seconds after takeoff from Gibraltar Airport, 11.07 p.m. on the 4th of July, 1943. Sofia, the daughter of General Sikorsky, who is also acting as his secretary and aide-de-camp. General Sikorsky, The only survivor of the crash was the pilot. Now, in almost any crash, anybody will tell you about the first person dies, the pilot. And he's the one in the front, he gets the impact, and so on. And the pilot's the only one who survived. They couldn't even retrieve most of the bodies. The notorious English agent Kim Philby, head of counterintelligence for MI6, was in Gibraltar at that time, as was the Soviet ambassador. His plane was on the airstrip at the same time. It was later found out that Kim Philby was also working for the KGB, and he ended his life as a Medal Order of Lenin recipient and so on in the Soviet Union. Well, Kim Philby probably got the orders from two sides, because Sikorsky was on the hit list for both the KGB, NKVD at that stage, and British MI6. Churchill received a phone call from FDR saying, you've got to stop Sikorsky. And Stalin had doubtless communicated something similar. And it was probably Kim Philby who did the job, and he probably got the orders from two sides at once. The Polish government refused to endorse the official report of the British Court of Inquiry, and to this day, they refuse to accept it. The Polish government a while ago ordered that his body, which is buried in Britain, be brought back to be buried in Poland. And at that stage, they made it very clear what they thought, because no British officials were invited to take part in the reburial. One of his memorials, and at the site in Gibraltar, they've got the propeller of the plane that went down. General Sikorsky, killed by Churchill in order to appease a dictator, Joseph Stalin. What do you mean there can be no compromise with dictators? Christians in Eastern Europe, who I ministered amongst before the Berlin Wall came down, from Poland all the way through to Albania, Christians in Eastern Europe have pointed out to me the hypocrisy of the Allied position and the duplicity of Churchill in particular. What freedom, they said. We never received any freedom. You betrayed us at the hands of Stalin's Soviet Union. They're referring to the Yalta Agreement. 15 nations, 100 million Christians, and that's not counting Ukraine and Russia, the Christians there who were betrayed. Just the countries of Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Yugoslavia, Albania. Shocking, absolutely shocking. 100 million Christians betrayed by Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Joseph Stalin. Churchill's unwavering support for Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin was also seen extraordinary sacrifice made through the so-called Lend-Lease. Over $11 billion, that's equivalent to $160 billion today, of weapons and strategic equipment was shipped to the Soviet Union during the Second World War. Of this, $6.8 billion came from the British and Commonwealth governments. And by the way, we were part of the Commonwealth at the time. Great Britain alone, between 1941 and 1945, delivered to the Soviet Union over 3,000 Hurricanes. That's one of the finest fighter planes. Over 1,000 Spitfires. Here's an official list of military hardware supplied by the United States to the Soviet Union from 1941. 13,000 tanks and armored vehicles. I mean, a lot of tanks. The poor German army thought that they had destroyed the Soviet tanks, and the first few months of the war suddenly started coming across these sort of things, Shermans and Lees. Where did they come from? And you can see on patrol all kinds of, like, and the T-34 tank is not a Russian design, it's an American design. The American tank designer Christie, he produced the design for this T-34, and the American government gave it to Stalin in the 1930s, before the Second World War, for the Russians to produce an American design tank. And Ford Motor Company provided the engines and everything else. And here you can see the British Crusader tanks in service with the Soviet Union. Here's the American Lee tank in service in the Soviet Union. You won't see that in Hollywood movies, even though most of the tanks were Western made. And here they are, ripping through Europe. That's a British Crusader tank. Sorry? No, this is a Churchill tank. That's Churchill tank. These are different tanks provided to them. 14,000 military aircraft, including massive bombers, huge amounts of planes shipped to the Soviet Union, including fighters, bombers. These are Russians training on American planes, as you can see. and Allied aircraft with Soviet red stars on the side. You don't see these pictures easily in war books. Here you've got, in Russia, DC-3. These are the same kind of planes I flew on up to the border. 77,000 jeeps, 375,000 trucks. Can you imagine trucks being shipped into the Soviet Union in such huge numbers? 35,000 motorcycles, 8,000 tractors, 15,000 artillery pieces, 131,000 machine guns, 1,900 locomotives, 90 cargo ships, 4.5 million tons of food supplies, over $1 billion of machinery and equipment, 2.5 million tons of petroleum products, 49,000 tons of leather, 3.7 million tires, 15 million pairs of army boots, 106,000 tons of cotton, building equipment valued at $10 billion. By the way, just remember, we're talking about, you cannot compromise with a dictator. This is the man who said the reason why he couldn't accept peace with Adolf Hitler, because he can't compromise with a dictator, but he could send all his weaponry to the Soviet Union, which was the most brutal dictatorship the world's ever known. And it just carries on. Along with 29 tankers, 433 combat ships, the US provided over 2 million tons of petroleum products, mobile bridges, railway equipment, aircraft, radio equipment, and many other items that weren't even listed. The US also delivered 470,000 tons of explosives. Can you imagine? The weaponry. 1.4 billion rounds of small arms ammunition, 21 million rounds of ammunition of 37 millimeters and larger sizes. Raw explosives delivered were enough for the Soviets to load more than 60 million artillery shells. 60 million artillery shells. The US sent 270,000 tons of rolled steel, enough to equip 15,000 T-34 tanks. And all the US effort resulted in an immense quantity of war materials delivered to the Soviet Union. Why the Germans and Scandinavians and volunteers from all over Europe were involved in Operation Barbarossa, trying to destroy communism, capitalists from the West were helping to save the Soviet Union from collapse. And these poor people who were busy working through the clock in Britain, in America, Canada, thinking we're helping provide the arsenal for democracy. And little did they know that actually they were helping Stalin. And it just carries on and on and on and on. It's just staggering. I mean, when you just look at, you know, 250 million buttons, for goodness sakes. It's just, this doesn't include the very generous aid given by Great Britain to the Soviet Union. Britain sent over 5,000 tanks, 5,500 Bosphorus anti-aircraft guns, 12 minesweepers, 5,800 aircraft, including 1,000 Spitfires, which is one of the best fighter aircraft ever produced. Over 3,000 Ukrainian. Look at this. All help for Russia now. I mean, these poor people here with the Soviet flag. And look at that. Are those fists? Are we seeing clenched fists here? And there can be no compromise with dictatorship. Britain sent over $1.7 billion worth of supplies to Stalin and Soviet Union. And this is while the people in Britain were sacrificing, rationing, thinking they're doing it for their war effort. Canada, they provided massive amounts, over 1 million artillery shells, and then 200,000 tons of wheat and flour. There is no doubt that without the Western aid, the Soviet Union wouldn't have been able to survive the year. Russian historian Boris Sokolov wrote in 1998, the Lend-Lease was the decisive factor in the Soviet ability to continue the war. They wouldn't have been able to keep fighting past December 1941 if it hadn't been for Lend-Lease. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. And all this military aid sent from Britain to the Soviet Union during the war was entirely free of charge. Well, not free from our perspective. The Soviet Union never paid a ruble for any of this generosity from Britain, which was greatly exceeded by the United States. However, Winston Churchill instructed his friend General Jan Smuts of South Africa, who had managed to consolidate the offices of Prime Minister, Minister of Defense, and Minister of Foreign Affairs. Have you ever heard of such a thing? In himself, Smuts had not been elected. He had just lost five elections in a row. because for the previous 15 years, General James Barry Hertzog, hero of the Anglo-Boer War, one top class judges, one of the youngest judges in South African history, James Barry Hertzog was the most popular and successful Prime Minister South Africa had ever had to that time. And he had never lost in any election. And now, because he wouldn't declare war on Germany, they did a coup in South Africa, just removed the elected Prime Minister, and without a referendum, without an election, Jan Smuts, the man who just lost five elections, becomes the head of state. Now, is this what we're talking about fighting for freedom and democracy? Which brings up another question. Who elected Winston Churchill? Do you know he never won an election for anything like that before? In fact, his first elections, he lost elections time and again. He regularly would get given a safe seat because he'd lost an election and had given another one that was safe in that party. He crossed the floor four times. He went, nobody in British political history has crossed the floor four times. It's changed parties so many times. It's just extraordinary. Jan Smuts was somebody who had also been like Churchill, not able to win an election, but he's able to take over and consolidate all the power in himself. What have happened to checks and balances? Well, by Churchill's request, General Smuts arranged for all the Southern gold above ground, over 20 million pounds of gold, in great secrecy, shipped by Simonstown, loaded at night on the USS Quincy, an American battle cruiser sent by Franklin Delano Roosevelt for the express purpose of transporting all South Africa's gold to New York to pay for America's extravagant, generous lend-lease to the Soviet Union. No wonder Winston Churchill said the truth needs a bodyguard of lies to protect it. And you think of these well-meaning people convinced we're going to fight to defend our island. We're going to fight for Christian civilization, for God and country. And they doubtless were sincere. And the sacrifice made by the families left behind. And all these people thinking all these sacrifices are for freedom, for democracy. And meanwhile, how much of this has been done for the Soviet Union and for Stalin and for the banksters? Absolutely incredible. Winston Churchill was the source of great speeches, but not good policies. Nor were his speeches true to reality. They did not even express his own personal principles. As many members of Parliament around him declared, Winston is entirely devoid of any principles at all. The only thing he cares about is himself. He even says in his own books, I don't actually care about the principles which I speak about. I'm only concerned about the impression the speeches make on the minds of my hearers. Rhodesian Prime Minister Ian Smith, who served all 6 years of the Second World War as a fighter pilot in the Royal Rhodesian Air Force and who was shot down behind enemy lines, declared upon reflection we would have been better off losing World War II, or even better, not getting involved in it at all. We lost more by winning than we would have lost by winning. Sorry, we lost more by winning than we would have lost by losing. If we'd lost, Britain would still be Britain, the Empire would still be there, Rhodesia would still be run, Soviet Union would be destroyed. You wouldn't have had the Cold War. In fact, Africa would still be run in partnership with Europe and be a paradise. And tens of millions of people in Africa died violently, or even more, by starvation, would have survived. With hindsight, we fought on the wrong side, Ian Smith said to me. The real enemy was communism. We did not realize it at the time, of course, but we were not really fighting for Christian civilization, as Winston was telling us. We weren't fighting for freedom because we were allied to Stalin's Russia. Instead of freeing Europe, we helped Stalin enslave half of it under communism. Now, I'm summarizing what he said over many times in many different ways in quite a few meetings that we had. Ian Smith told me it would have been better if Britain had stayed out of the war and let Germany smash communism in Russia once and for all. Or better still, we should have actually helped free Russia from communism. That would have spared a lot of people a lot of grief. Darkest Hour, the film that's about to get all these Academy Awards, suggests that Winston Churchill was a principled person concerned with doing the right thing. However, his track record would suggest otherwise. His political record is of an opportunist who crossed the floor and leapfrogged to other parties at an incredible four times. Depending on how the political winds were blowing, he moved from conservative to liberal, to constitutionalist and back to conservative, changing party loyalty in order to gain high political office. As James Marley declared in 1908, Winston has no principles. In 1913, A.J. Gardner declared, Winston will write his name in history, in blood. Yet a 2002 BBC poll declared that the people of Britain consider Winston Churchill the greatest Briton of all time. Of all time? I mean, forget King Arthur, King Alfred the Great, Queen Elizabeth I, forget Oliver Cromwell, forget any of the people that people would have looked at over the years, or even his own great-grandfather, the Duke of Marlborough, John Churchill, who was a great soldier, actually. Won the Battle of Blenheim as an ally of Germany, by the way, fighting against the French. Churchill is certainly one of the most extraordinary people of the 20th century. He came under fire as a correspondent attached to the Spanish army in Cuba during the war there. He fought with the Malakand field force in India, and at Afghanistan he rode in the last cavalry charge of the empire at Omdurman. He was taken prisoner in Anglo-Boer War. He escaped to write best-selling books about his war experiences, and he became an international celebrity and entered Parliament at 26 years old. By the way, he said, "The most terrifying sound I ever heard in my life was the night I was captured by the Boers. I heard them singing psalms. And I said, my God, what enemies are these? What kind of people are we fighting? They have the better cause." And yet he supported all the atrocities of scorched earth and concentration camps. At 36, he was the first Lord of the Admiralty, where he has the most powerful voice in the British cabinet for war. Cashiered after Dardanelles Gallipoli disaster, Churchill spent some time at the Ypres front. Interestingly enough, for a few months he was opposite Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler was in the Bavarian corps just on the other side in Ypres, where he got gassed and was blind for 4 months. Interesting, two artists who became heads of state on opposite sides were at the same battlefront for just a short while. And he became Minister of War and Air in Lloyd George's cabinet. He was at the center of power for most of the first half of the 20th century, and he participated in all the great decisions of Britain which affected its decline in the 20th century. Possibly the most famous of all British prime ministers, his speeches and quotes have been some of the most admired and repeated in history. And to be honest, some of the speeches are really great, and a lot of his quotes are really quotable. I mean, he is a great speech maker and a great writer. He's just a terrible politician. However, not since fictional personages like Zeus and Hercules have so many myths been attached to one man. Most people today know more about the myths of Churchill than the facts behind the fantasy. Here's just a few little glimpses into Churchill's career. Churchill's report on his participation in a punitive expedition into Afghanistan reads like the records of a war criminal. This is quoting from his book. "We proceeded systematically, village by village. We destroyed the houses, filled up the wells, blew up the towers, cut down the great shady trees, burned the crops, and broke the reservoirs in punitive devastation. All who resist will be killed without quarter, because the Pushans need to recognize the superiority of our race. Every tribe in court was speared or cut down at once." And he doesn't seem to have any moral problems with this. The people of India are not particularly fond of Winston Churchill either. He wrote, "I hate Indians. They're a beastly people with a beastly religion. Bengal had a better than normal harvest in 1943, and fearful that the Japanese may invade and benefit from this harvest, Churchill ordered the British army to ship tons of rice away from the starving people to the Middle East, where they didn't even need it, in order to create a scorched earth effect so that if the Japanese did invade, they would starve. When the starving people of Bengal asked for food, Churchill declared the famine was their fault for breeding like rabbits. And the Viceroy of India complained, Churchill's attitude towards India is negligent, hostile, and contemptuous. British Secretary of State in India, Leo Emery, declared that he did not see much difference between Churchill's outlook and Hitler's." This is during the war when all the propaganda would have been totally hostile to Hitler. So to compare Churchill with Hitler was quite, in fact, that could have ended you up in detention and so on by security branch under Emergency Act of May 22, 1940. Canada offered 10,000 tons of rice to India, and the United States offered 100,000 tons. Churchill point blank refused to allow any aid to go through to Indians starving in Bengal. When he heard that Mahatma Gandhi was fasting and protest against his British rule, he declared he had rather see Gandhi trampled to death by an elephant riding with the Viceroy riding on its back. And he later questioned the Viceroy, "Why isn't Gandhi dead yet?" Over 4 million Indians are estimated to have died in the Bengal famine of 1943, and that's the lowest estimate. I've seen people claiming it was up to 15 million, but I've taken the lowest stat, although the Indians claim it was a lot more than that. Iranians, remember that Churchill supported the joint invasion of neutral Persia by Soviet, British and American forces during 1941 to provide a supply line for Western weapons and strategic supplies to be shipped to Stalin's Soviet Union. And so in 1941, the Allies opened up this corridor through Iran to Russia, and that was made possible by the completion 1939 of the Trans-Iranian Railroad, which linked the Persian Gulf with other points around Iran, including the Russian border, and with hindsight seeing that they were planning this invasion long before the war even began. The British and Soviets worked together in a joint operation to overthrow the Tsar and seize control of Iran and its strategic railroad. And thereafter, the Allied convoys from America could sail around the Cape of Good Hope, unload the cargoes at ports in both Iran and Iraq, and that route was responsible for delivering over 25% of the total supplies of Lend-Lease sent to the Soviet Union. Later in 1953, when Winston Churchill was Prime Minister of Great Britain, in 1950 he actually was elected for the first time, and that was on the war propaganda, he again supported the CIA operation called Operation Ajax that organized a coup against the first democratically elected government of Iran and replaced it with a dictatorship. When Iranians complain today about what the CIA and the British MI6 and others have done to them, they actually have a point. The people in Iraq will remind you that when Winston Churchill was Secretary of State for the colonies in 1921, he redrew the map to create the present states of oil-rich Kuwait, which happens to take most of the oil of Iraq. He separated Iraq and ensured that the Kurds did not rule themselves. So the Kurds were separated between Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. And with some Iraqi tribes, he and the Kurds, when they objected to signing away their rights to rule themselves, see, Kurdistan should be bigger than Turkey. But although the Kurds are more numerous than the population of Iraq and so on, they have not been allowed to rule themselves. They were divided between effectively Turkey, Iraq, and Iran. And the Kurds, by the way, are the Medes. And when you read about the Medes and the Persians, Darius the Mede, the one who threw Daniel into the lion's den, that was a Mede, a Kurd. So the Kurds and the Medes are the same people. When they started to object, Winston Churchill advocated the use of mustard and poisonous gases. As Secretary for War and Air now, he advised the provision of some kind of asphyxiating bombs for use in preliminary operations against turbulent tribes in Mesopotamia. That's Kurdistan, Iraq. Bomber Harris observed of Churchill's bombings of civilians in Mesopotamia, "The Arab and the Kurd now know what a real bombing means. Within 15 minutes, a full-sized village can be practically wiped out, and a third of its inhabitants killed or injured by four or five machines, which offer them no real target, no opportunity for being glorious warriors, no effective means of escape." You'll notice this is not a criticism, this is praise. Bomber Harris was the man who orchestrated, under Churchill's command, the strategic bombing campaigns. The people of Ireland remind one that when Churchill was Minister of Home Affairs, he sent the Black and Tans, that was a unit he created, to rampage across the country to carry out reprisals. He advocated the use of fighter aircraft to disperse Irish mobs with machine gun fire and bombs to scatter and stampede them. He sent in Mark IV tanks into the streets, and they flattened Dublin. And, yeah, oh, good thing this wasn't South African police doing something. Imagine what they would have done with those pictures. In Kenya, the people remind you that when Winston Churchill was Prime Minister of Kenya, he declared a state of emergency. When he was Prime Minister of Britain, he ordered a state of emergency declared in Kenya, 1952, ordered 150,000 men, women, children forced into concentration camps and forced to do hard labor without charge. As far as Churchill's claim there can be no compromise with dictators, he raised the British payment to Bedouin bandit Ibn Saud, after whom Saudi Arabia is named, and he's the one who turned Saudi Arabia into a Wahhabian dictatorship where they behead people by the hundreds every year. He ordered him to be receiving a personal payout from the British government of £100,000 a year. Now, this is stupendous at that time. Just imagine. A stupendous sum. My admiration for Ibn Saud was deep because of his unfailing loyalty to us. Oh, so evidently being a dictator is not so bad when you're loyal to British political aims. Churchill himself described Ebon Saud as tolerant, intolerant, well-armed, and bloodthirsty. But as long as we're on the British side, that's good enough for Winston. In 1940s, he gifted Ebon Saud with a special Rolls Royce. There can be no compromise with dictators. As far as concern for human rights goes, Churchill wrote approvingly of the British concentration camps and scorched earth policy during the Anglo-Boer War. It was great fun galloping about in South Africa, he said. Far from being pro-life, when he was Home Secretary, Churchill enthusiastically supported forcibly sterilizing the feeble-minded, as he called them, and putting them in labor camps. He ordered 100,000 degenerate Britons to be put in labor camps to halt the decline of the British race. He also suggested tramps, beggars, and wastrels should be sent to labor colonies. Now, how is this different from what he's criticizing Adolf Hitler from doing? Although Winston Churchill made a name for himself as an opponent of socialism, both before and after the First World War, with brilliant comments like, socialism can only work in heaven where they don't need it, and in hell where they already have it. They're great quotes. But he did put in place a severe national socialism in wartime Britain while he was Prime Minister. As the Mises Institute observed in 1950, it is noteworthy to remember that British socialism is not an achievement of Clement Attlee's Labour government, but of the War Cabinet of Winston Churchill. Churchill, as colonial secretary, invented two client kingdoms, Transjordan and Iraq, both artificial and unstable states. He denied the Kurds their own homeland. He carved out most of Iraq's oil fields into a new state called Kuwait, which Britain basically owns through the British Petroleum, BP. In a letter to his mother, Winston Churchill stated, I do not accept the Christian or any other form of religious belief. He said he believed in Darwinian policy of survival of the fittest, as when he was in Afghanistan, we a superior race, we kill all of them. He quoted positively from William Ernest Henley's viciously anti-God poem, Invictus, I'm the master of my fate, I'm the captain of my soul. And he even inserted that in some of his wartime speeches. As Patrick Buchanan points out, Churchill chose as his enemy Hitler, who wanted the British Empire to survive and endure, and chose as his ally Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was determined to dismantle the British Empire. Asked how he could ally with Stalin, whose crimes he knew so well, Churchill answered he had only one single purpose in his life, the destruction of Hitler, and my life is much simplified thereby. If Hitler invaded hell, I would at least make a favorable reference to the devil. Well, he couldn't have been more hell-bent than in supporting Stalin. During a September 1942 trip to Moscow, where Churchill enjoyed a 19-course meal. Imagine a 19-course meal. How on earth does anyone eat a 19-course meal? That's all gallons of alcohol consumed. Churchill asked Stalin, have you forgiven me? Yeah, for things he'd said against Bolshevism in the past. All that's in the past, it's not for me to forgive, it's for God to forgive, says Stalin. I mean, can you imagine this kind of conversation? On his return, Churchill rose in Parliament to tell his countrymen that they were fortunate to be allied with such a great man as Joseph Stalin. This great, rugged war chief is a man of massive, outstanding personality, a man of inexhaustible courage and willpower, a great man. Stalin has left me with the impression of a deep, cool wisdom and a complete absence of illusions of any kind. I mean, Churchill plainly sold his soul to the devil long before this. Churchill's concessions at Yalta were far worse than anything that Chamberlain made at Munich. As Pat Buchanan points out, the Sudeten Germans were clamoring to rejoin Germany. They just wanted to be back under German rule as they'd been in part of the Austrian Empire just a short while before. But the Poles were terrified of Stalin's Soviet Union. They were horrified to be incorporated, and he sold 40% of Poland into the Soviet Union. The rest was basically a client state under their control anyway. At Yalta in February 1945, Churchill gave moral legitimacy to Stalin's brutal dictatorship, seizing half of Europe. 100 million Christians, east of the Oder River, had to watch what democracy they had known, what freedom they'd known before the war disappear. And that then suffered the added humiliation of seeing such words as free elections, sovereignty, democracy, independence, liberation, deliberately corrupted, debased, made duplicitous in a declaration of liberated Europe. That's what they call it, the Declaration of Liberated Europe. The very title of which, given the ugly reality underneath, is a piece of calculated Soviet effrontery. One, however, that both Churchill and FDR acquiesced in. I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Winston Churchill upon reflection, are two of the most wicked war criminals in the history of mankind. To Churchill, the independence and freedom of 100 million Christian peoples of Eastern Europe, amongst whom Bill Bathman spent 60 years ministering, and I made many precious friends. They weren't worth a war with Russia in 1945. Well, then why was Poland worth a war with Germany in 1939? Did Churchill even care about Poland? No, he didn't. He expressed his contempt for the Polish leaders and the Polish people with whom Britain had been allied on. In his History of the Second World War, he describes the Poles as the vilest of the vile. The vilest of the vile. Which I think they could describe him as. Was it worth bankrupting and bleeding his country and bringing down the empire for the betrayal of Eastern Europe and the bankrupting of the British Empire? Was it worth declaring war to keep 350,000 Danzigers separate from the Germany they wished to rejoin? Churchill had earlier described the Soviet regime as a vile combination of criminality and animalism. Yet Churchill colluded with Stalin in monstrous crimes as the forcible return of millions of Russians, Ukrainians, and other East Europeans from Allied occupied territory into the hands of Stalin's NKVD, what they call the last secret. Hardly. This is Operation Keelhaul. And James Barks documents other losses. Horrific. More German soldiers died as prisoners of war after the war than died in combat during the war. And something in a region of 15 to possibly 18 million German civilians died after the Second World War was over, most in Eastern hands, but not only. The true legacy of Winston Churchill is the collapse of the British Empire. The British Empire was colossal, massive. One quarter of the world's land surface and population. It was a great empire, and we were part of it in Rhodesia and South Africa. The British Empire in 1937, and I mean gone. How could the greatest economic, political, military, and spiritual superpower of the world suddenly just vanish in such short time? Well, Winston Churchill's decisions and the foolish wars he embarked on are most of the answer to that. And the betrayal of Eastern Europe at the hands of the Soviet Union. That's his legacy. From his entry into the inner cabinet as First Lord Admiralty in 1911 to his final departure from 10 Downing Street in 1955. In that half century, it encapsulates the collapse of British power worldwide. And Winston Churchill, more than any other single human being, is responsible for that. He's not the greatest Briton of all time. He's the worst Briton of all time. No person did more damage to the British Empire than Winston Churchill. The saturation bombings of cities in Germany destroyed more than Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun combined. His deportations under Operation Keelhaul were amongst the greatest crimes committed in the 20th century. Just consider the Allied bombing offensives on Germany and Holland and Belgium and Luxembourg and France, all of liberated Europe. Great being liberated. You know, if you don't come to democracy, democracy comes to you. And this is freedom. This is democracy. This is liberation. This is what it means to be liberated, it would seem. And they were very, very proud of their bombing of cities like Dresden. I mean, they boasted about it. And you look at this. This is what Dresden used to look like. They called it the Venice of the North. And that's what it looked like after the bombing. I mean, this is a Holocaust. This is a war crime of the highest order, capital of Saxony. And so I believe it is vital for us to recognize a person like Winston Churchill for what he was. I mean, this has been so well documented. David Irving has done a lot of work and so have many others. Yalt is a swear word in Eastern Europe. The Churchill cult and the mythology of Churchill has been used to justify many unjust wars, such as the recent war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq and the present one against Assad Syria. Because every enemy of America, Britain, is a new Hitler, and it's always 1938, and every leader of America is now a new Winston Churchill. And this Churchillian cult has been used to justify all kinds of indefensible wars. The deifying of Winston Churchill and his indefensible hell-bent determination to save the Soviet Union and ally with Stalin in order to bring down Germany precipitated the downfall of Western Christian civilization. Today we live with a catastrophic consequence of Churchill and FDR's disastrous policies. I would call them two of the worst people to have ever afflicted Western civilization. 2 Peter 2:19, while it promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. I mean, this, you could see Churchill and FDR, they were soulmates. I mean, they were perverted, self-indulgent drunkards. Yep, as Churchill said, success is the ability to go from one failure to another with no loss of enthusiasm. And there he is with one of his favorite bankers. A correct understanding of the past is an indispensable aid to making a better future. The truth is not any stranger than fiction, it's more gripping and more impressive. If Hollywood wants to make good films, they should base it on the real story, the real history, and we'll find it's far more interesting, far more gripping, far more amazing. And these are just some of the books that have guided me in putting together this presentation.